The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, Crit Nation. We wanted to do something special. We're not sure if everyone knows, but we started delving into other tabletop RPGs on our new show, Dice and Dialogue. Now, enjoy this episode of Dice and Dialogue, and make sure to head on over to rebrand.ly/Dice and Dialogue and subscribe to our new RSS feed and make sure you don't miss out on any episodes.
Join Dice and Dialogue, Cypher System RPG Part 1 miniseries as we delve into the history and wonder of the Ninth World, a unique setting in Numenera tabletop game that combines science fiction and fantasy elements to create a world of mystery and danger. From the lush forest of the Steadfast to the floating islands of the Cloud Crystal Skyfields, the Ninth World is a world waiting to be explored.
Hello and welcome, heroes, to Crit Academy Dice and Dialogue. I am your host, Justin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your co-host, Alex.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon.
We are super excited to start the very first episode of our new show, Dice and Dialogue. How are you guys feeling about that?
Pretty good.
I'm happy to be here.
Let's see where this goes.
Hopefully it goes a very long way. If you don't know, welcome. We are the Crit Academy, and you may know us from such episodes as Crit Academy, our 300th episode that just aired. and we're super excited to expand our show content, right? We've been covering Dungeons & Dragons specifically for 300 episodes, and we wanted to do something a little more fun. And that includes bringing on another wonderful host to kind of help flesh out the discussion, because nobody wants to hear just the opinion of three white dudes, so...
Although you described every single radio show in existence practically.
Fair enough. So we recently decided we are going to have this tabletop RPG show, and we're going to be talking about tabletop games, RPG games, going into the variety of different games, because there are thousands of amazing RPGs out there.
And basically we just wanted to branch out to the cover just D&D, but we also want to cover other systems, and we also want to focus on content that's something agnostic that you can use in any game you play.
Absolutely. Yes. So, go ahead.
I'm just excited to talk about what we did, because we ran the game, what was it, 2 nights ago, and yep. It was fucking awesome.
Yes, we played Numenera, which runs on the Cypher system, so...
Which we might accidentally use interchangeably during this episode.
Yes, yeah, because, honestly, yeah, it's... Yeah. The Cypher system is very wide. We specifically will be talking about Numenera and then some of the details of the Cypher system. But yep. First, we want to talk about our first experience.
Yep. But just so we're clear, Cypher system is the game engine. Numenera is the setting.
Correct. And Cypher system is very versatile. In fact, in the book, it basically gives you the tools you need to run in pretty much any genre of game.
Yep. And man, does that help knowing that ahead of time.
So, Alex, as our newest member, would you like to start the conversation off of your experience with the Cypher system? Now, we want to make sure the audience knows this is, for most of us, I think, this is our first time playing the Numenera and the Cypher system.
It was my second, but my first time was at a con, one session a few years back at Dragon Con. Okay. So... And I actually think going through the rules this time and playing the session made that session make a little bit more sense.
Right.
And I do want to stress that so far we've only played one game, and this is kind of our first impressions of what we think of it so far.
That's good. Alex, why don't you get the ball rolling?
So I think that Numenera and... Okay, so first of all, the Cypher system was so... open. It was actually a little hard to grasp at first how open it was. But as you play it, I would definitely recommend the Cypher system be something that you learn through videos and watching other people play and playing yourself more than just sitting down and reading the book, because your own mind kind of limits how vast and open the Cypher system is whenever it's way more than you expect. Like, you can do so much stuff. You can have any weapon that you can think of. It just matters if it's light, medium, or heavy. And it was going into it, I was definitely nervous because it is a 400-page book. We can't deny that that's a lot of pages. And I am very bad at reading. And so I'm extremely dyslexic. And so I'm very bad at reading. And so it was daunting. Definitely whenever you pick up the book and it's 400 pages, you're like, because they had it at my local library. So I went and looked at it. And it's a hefty, but like, it's way easier to pick up than I thought it was going to be. And so overall, I had a really positive experience with it. I definitely would like to look a little bit more into, like, I would love to have a discussion about all of our issues with equipment. But besides that, I can't really think of an issue that I had with it.
Yep. Now, I do think it's fair that once we got it figured out, after that, I was like, oh, okay. But that could be something that could be a stumbling block out in the beginning, to be fair.
So when we started this game,
and actually, I do want to say it's worth noting, too, that there is a CRD you can download for free off the website.
Yep, and there's even websites. SRD, you mean?
I couldn't find one.
I shared it, and there's a link to it. But anyways, so, Brandon, would you like to tell us about your experience? And then we're going to actually talk about our game.
Yes.
Specifically.
We'll get there eventually.
My experience, well, first off, everyone who's watched the show knows that I'm lazy. Yeah, I'm lazy, and I always do things last minute.
Yeah, you talk as if that's a selling point.
No.
It's not.
The point is that I was able to sit down and read through the book, and it was very straightforward.
Were you on the toilet?
No.
I feel like that's the only place you would have time as a dad.
No, I actually stayed up beyond my bedtime to make sure it was done.
Who cares?
Because you yelled at me the week before. it was like Alex was saying, weapons are small, medium, and heavy. It's the same thing with the armor, and it's a very simple math system, so you don't have to be good at that. So that's pretty neat.
Yep.
The addition of the three attributes, abilities that we had.
Might, speed, and intellect.
Yeah, might, speed, and intellect, and how those worked, and how you can apply effort and have edge and stuff. It's like, that doesn't make sense when you read the book. You know what this reminds me of? This is a really good way of putting it.
What?
It reminds me of learning the Rubik's Cube.
Okay.
It is really confusing in the beginning, but when you understand it, it's like, oh, this is simple. I get it.
So accurate. Oh my god. That's so accurate.
It's like dominoes too.
Yeah, everything seems complex when you start, but same thing with like chess and stuff. But Ian,
I do want to point out that I do thought it was interesting that all three of us did sit down and we all made completely different characters.
Yep.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And without even trying. Yeah. And that was definitely really nice.
Yeah, I my personal experience was as the game master. So, we had somebody lined up, something fell through, and unfortunately, you got to take care of family first. You know, Dom says it best.
Yep,
you got family. You know, but I really enjoyed the storytelling focus, and that's really what Cypher System focuses and strives to focus on, which is the story and the group telling experience.
Yep.
The thing that I thought was most surprising, and we'll just segue right into our campaign, we ran the starter set, and the setting immediately feels different.
Oh yeah.
And I think that was one of my the biggest things. The Ninth World is basically built on the stage of like 8 previous civilizations that have risen and fallen. And you felt that come through in the story.
Yep.
What are you giggling about?
The Staff of Destruction.
Oh goodness! Do you want to talk a little bit about how that came into the story? And
okay, so I don't know how it began, but a Numenera is pretty much lost technology, but the people in the Ninth World see this lost technology as magic. It's like taking a laptop and giving it to a caveman. Like, oh, what is this? It's the same concept. And the village that my character came from, they had a staff of destruction that was stolen. So they went to go look for it, and they eventually found it.
What was the purpose of the Staff of Destruction? Do you remember?
To blow shit up, apparently.
To defend the village, right?
To defend the village. Now, is the Staff of Destruction like actually in that Numenera Star Center, or did you throw that in there?
I threw it in there based off your story. I was like, there needs to be a reason you're going here. I was like, that's a perfect one.
Yep.
Oh my God. See that? Just right at the top of your head. I like that. Now, it turns out that it's like, oh, you found it, and this guy's being attacked by tentacles. What are you going to do?
You don't know how it worked, though.
You can use it? It's like, I don't know how it works. It's like, why don't you ask
the god?
This god that everyone knows about.
Which is so, basically Alexa.
So he asked Alexa, and she said, oh, you do this, this, this. And I was like, it's a fucking RPG. It's not a Staff of Destruction. It's a rocket launcher. Well, of course, our characters didn't know that. So as far as they're concerned, it shot a magic bolt of metal. And
well, they don't know it. Do they know it's metal? Because all you're going to see is the big right flash of fire and destruction. What do you think about that, Alex?
So
anything like that come across to you?
I definitely thought that the starter kit was a really, really good first adventure. There were definitely times that I was confused as to what to do, but also, I mean, like, isn't any first session like that? The thing that I will say that is so fascinating is that there is, and I looked into the lore, so if you want me to talk about the lore of the world and like the...
Well, that's definitely the good segue into it if you want, because that's kind of the next, what we're supposed to be talking about anyway. So
to TLDR, the history in the world of Numenera, essentially what happened is millions and millions of years later, Pangaea has reformed, a new Pangaea. And there has been 9 apocalyptic scenarios. If you consider an apocalypse a decrease in the human population to the point of almost extinction, there have been 9 or 8 different apocalypse scenarios that have happened, each scarring the world, each one of the civilizations of those 8 having their imprint on the world. So you might go down into a cave and find ruins from 1 million years ago, and then go down even farther and find ruins from 3 million years ago, because they just built on top of each other. At this point in time, at the point that Numenera is set in, basically a new world is blooming. So what has happened is it died down to like 100, and like I think what they were inferencing is like 100,000 people was all what was left of the human race on the surface. Other people have ascended to stars, other people have died, other wars, you know, whatever, but there's like 100,000 people, and then it starts blooming over again, because apparently the largest city in Numenera is 500,000 people, which is nothing. Whenever you think about large cities.
That's chicken scratch.
Yeah. So basically what happened is like we are in a new bloom, and that's where this is taking place. There's new civilization coming up. They're trying to figure out stuff about the world. They're trying to figure out stuff about all the different technologies. I was actually described to it that they know that it's technology and they know how to work the technology. A lot of times they know how to work the technology from like just pressing buttons and doing it, but they don't know how to repair it. They don't know how to create it. They don't know. So it's like magic in a sense, but they do know that it's not like divine or some energy force. They know that there's some kind of physics happening inside of the device. And so this world is also filled – this world is filled with creatures that are amalgamation of aliens, technology, hybrids, and things that have just survived this entire time. And so it's just – it's very fascinating. It's sci-fi fantasy true, like true sci-fi fantasy.
I think what did it really well – oh, I think and maybe that was my misunderstanding. I was watching a video from Monty Cook that used the analogy that – in Ninth World.
Science became so advanced that magic got blurred together.
Yeah, it was indistinguishable. Oh, okay. So, that was just from something I watched with him. Obviously, I've only touched the surface of this thick
The engine book, not the setting book.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyways, so it's worth noting that this is a very diverse world, which means when you create your character... And we'll walk through that on the next episode in great detail. But when you create your character, you're really not limited to a lot of stuff. And that's how it captures the diversity. Brandon, in the game we ran, you were asking about weapons.
Yep.
And it's basically broken down to light,
medium, and heavy.
Medium and heavy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't give you what those are. So you decided, well, I'm going to rock the Gundam wing look with the giant energy scythe. Okay.
Just simple things. Like, medium is a standard for everyone. Heavy has to be well-wielded with two hands.
Slows you down, too.
Yep.
And light was, like, 2 damage, but there was a buff to it. I forgot what it was. It was, like...
You can attack twice with light weapons.
Is that what it was? Yes, you get to attack twice.
Yeah.
So, this diverse world that Alex just explained to us, you're encouraged to leverage that during your, you know, character creation process. And what I think makes it amazing, not only do we have the 8 different worlds that preceded it, you as the GM can decide what those were if you want, and thus everything the player characters discover can be tied to a particular feeling that you want. So when you guys first started the starter adventure, you come across this big giant, almost like tomb-like pyramid thing or octagon or whatever shape it was. I don't already forgot, but
yeah, beehive.
That looked like it basically yeah. just was ancient, but where it appeared looked like it had just gotten there.
Yep.
It turns out it was a holy temple of teleporting that teleports around, right?
Yep.
And it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside and all that jazz. So as the players, how did you guys feel when you ran into this thing and as players not actually knowing what it is being described?
Intimidated.
Really?
Yep. Like, I just remember at one point where you had us like we decided to, quote, join the cult, if anything, so we could gain access to the deity.
Yep.
And in order to pass you an initiation, like enter the vortex. And as you describe it, I walked inside like, wait a second, is this a hot tub?
That's exactly what it was.
You know what's really messed up about that is that ready to action that I had.
Yep.
You want the quote unquote, because there's no ready to action in this game.
Actually, there is.
I looked it up after he said that there was.
That's cool. But what was it? It's like, if the doors to this place start closing, I want to know. That's because if the doors are going to start closing, I was going to use my cipher and teleport into the doors. And then after he discovered what this place was, that was going to be it for my character. That place would have left, and I was going to be gone.
And that's actually a good segue to mentioning the ciphers, which is a unique part of the system.
Yeah, do you want to go with that?
Basically, like, the ciphers are kind of like this archaeotech that we kind of mentioned before, and you're expected to come across it very frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And when you use it, you get like a special feature, but in theory, once you use it, it's gone. And in theory, each character can slot it a certain number of times. Like, most people can only do 2, but because I chose the Adept class, I could actually slot up to 3. But...
What?
And that's one of the things I really like about the game, because it encourages you to use those.
Yeah.
Because now, I didn't delve into this much for our first game, because honestly,
yep.
it's kind of overwhelming.
Yeah.
But it encourages you to let the player characters discover these ciphers often, so that they use them all the time. But they don't necessarily always know what they do. It's up to the GM whether they reveal what it does or not.
Yep.
And in fact, in this adventure... The ritual people, I'm not going to, it's an order of the vortex,
cult.
Not a cult, stop it, the
cult.
Order of the vortex, actually, they collect these and then sacrifice them to their deity, the vortex, and somebody, you know, managed to get their hands on one and activated it and turned them into this giant, slithering, tentacled monster, because they didn't know what it did.
Yep.
And so that person became the enemy.
Even if they weren't necessarily by default.
Right.
An enemy to begin with.
I gotta tell you what, though. Alex was pretty ballsy in that situation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
He's like, oh, what's going on in this room? He's like, I don't know. Fuck it. Just open the door and go in and attack.
No. I didn't open the door and go in. I opened the door and threw a grenade.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Kaboom.
Which was a cipher.
Yep. That's another. Yep.
A cipher. She lessened the blow.
Yeah, and that was funny because I totally stripped a line from Independence Day for that. I had the person, they were looking into this like foggy, steamy room, and
you.
A face smashed up against the window with a tentacle wrapped around its throat saying, release me!
Yep. And
I was 13 when that movie came out.
I know, we're so fucking old.
I didn't mention this at the time because it didn't really come up, but the guy who ended up being like the head of the order?
Mm-hmm.
Appraisal?
Yes. I actually could have sold him just because of the cipher I picked.
Oh, yeah?
Because you know how he made a big deal that he had the huge energy shield, which would take a lot of damage, right? Well, the cipher I picked would, for about 1 minute, put me out of phase. I could not interact with anything physically that could interact physically with me. And because I was an adept and I chose the command mental power ability, it's like, I don't have to interact with stuff mentally. I can use my onslaught ability and use a mindless ability, which ignores armor anyway. And just pump it up.
So
it's like, you can't do anything to me for 1 minute. In theory, I can take him down that time frame.
I love that that's the first thing he thinks about when he runs up against this dude. Like, oh, he must be the bad guy. He's got a big walking barrier around him, which he could have been. So let's talk a little bit more about the unique world, because I think that this is an important aspect of this game. And the fact that you can engage with it. Technology in a way that it's fun for the players, like the Staff of Destruction. Like the look on his face when he realized it was just a damn bazooka was amazing. Or when Ian's like, "Oh my god, it's a hot tub!" Like when I described it, I described it exactly as it would be, right?
Right.
But that's not where your head goes in a game like that.
No. And the nice thing about the setting too, in Numenera, and for that matter, the Cypress itself is because it, for the most part, blends tech and magic together. You can run anything you want in this setting. You want to be weird.
I want to run Gundams.
I think one of my favorite things about this setting is how masterfully they blended together fantasy and sci-fi. Yeah. I find it really difficult to do that. I the only thing that I can think of off the top of my head that blended that together very well is Treasure Planet. Or the Lost City of Atlantis.
Movie.
But like besides those things, I can't really think of something that blends technology and fantasy together so seamlessly. And it really, you might think originally, you might hear, like such a fantasy world sci-fi where they're using torches, but they also have like technology, like they have like motorcycles. What you might sit there and think that it would be a difficult thing to dungeon master, but actually whenever you get into it, I find that would be very easy to dungeon master. And Justin had a really fun idea, and I think that this is something that a lot of people could do in their games, where you take everyday objects that would have been invented by these technologies, by these people, and you insert them into the world and just wait for it to click. I think that is such a fun, like metagamey, but also like interesting thing that then your players start looking out for items. So now instead of your players being on the defense, they're now on the offense. And that's always a really, really good feeling as a dungeon master whenever the players are interacting, whenever the players want to. They are seeking, they are doing. And so I really cannot get over how seamlessly they blended the two together.
Yeah.
I do want to point for the record, instead of like commands, mental powers, I almost took power armor instead because I thought it was hilarious to be a mage in a mech suit.
Oh, that's hilarious. I love that. But that's so that goes again to the diversity that it offers.
And it would have worked.
And what I really found fun, and kind of she's pointed that out, Alex has pointed that out already, was that even in the descriptions of when you guys were adventuring through the forest and I was creating a scene, I had to improv a specific type of scene to make it feel that fantasy thing. So I'm scrolling through the book really quick, and you know, I found a mechanical bird. And so I included that into the setting as if something that's just flying around, because that's what you would see in a place like this.
Yep.
And that drew the character's attention, specifically the one with the skills in like technology and supernatural stuff, just to learn what about the creature.
It's a drone?
It's a drone.
Yep.
I mean, all I thought was, hey, let's use this monster like a pigeon, except instead of a pigeon, it's a damn drone.
Okay, well, wait. It's not just a drone. Like, okay, I have to say this because you read this directly from the book, I think, and it's like one of my favorite things. It started as a drone. Now, it has, since it was AI, since everything is AI, it has a personality of its own, and it tricks people and lies to people. So you can't trust these drones anymore.
Oh, yeah.
There's evolution, though. That's evolution. That is specifically putting in a period of long time into the history of a bird. That's cool.
Bird's the word.
You're welcome. I'm not giving Monty Cook that. That was all me.
Wait, really?
Yes.
I wrote it while one of you guys were talking.
That was such a good idea, though.
Because it talked about the AI and stuff. Yeah, it talked about the AI. I was like, what if the AI learned? Yeah. Because I've been listening to all these things, people talking with ChatGPT and how they're going crazy from it. And I was like, what if that happened with this? So I just wrote like three sentences out about it while you guys were discussing. Yeah. And I was like, this is awesome. I'm going to include it. But I did get the stat block and monster idea from the book, though.
I still remember in ChatGPT, like, I'm playing a character in this setting, but I can't think of a background. ChatGPT, what's the background for a character with quest in this setting? Holy crap, this is actually pretty good.
So... is there anything else we want to talk about? We didn't really talk much about the environments. I think one of the things that I was reading that was really, really cool is how different the environment can be from mile to mile, right? Because ancient, ships and technology and stuff crashing all the time, you might start in a desert and then end up in a giant lush forest in the middle of it, not because of some natural phenomenon, but some interstellar ship crashed there that had a really large atrium or something, and that's still surviving today, being ran around and supported by the remaining robots and AI and stuff that were on the ship keeping it running.
And the date this episode, for anybody who's going to be listening to it 5 years from now... Ant-Man Quantumania came out this weekend, and I actually think the way they present the Quantumverse would be right at home in the setting, too.
I have not seen it, and I'm really sad.
Turns out the spaceship brings an invasive species to the planet.
Well, yeah. No, that's literally out. What I was about to say. The planet has been shaped by invasive... like, literally, it's to the point where we have alien, extraterrestrial invasive species, and people are like, oh, you can eat them. You can eat them,
it tastes like chicken, because everything tastes like chicken. Unless, was it in Matrix where they talk about, why does chicken taste like everything? Do you think it's because the robots that made the Matrix didn't know what chicken tastes like? That's why everything tastes like chicken? But those are things too, like there's so much you can do with this, whether it's dangerous creatures, robots, mix and matched, cybernetic ones. Like, who the hell doesn't want a T-Rex with giant laser cannons on its shoulders? Like, or sharks with laser beams attached to their freaking heads. No?
Nobody? Yeah,
freaking sharks with freaking laser beams attached to their freaking heads.
I love you guys, all of you. But that's the sort of stuff as a GM that's fun to play with and to think about in the world setting. That's why I was so captivated by Numenera.
Yep. Like I said, you can throw anything in the setting and it won't be weird.
And that is awesome. And you get to play with things like extra dimensional portals and stuff too, right?
Yeah.
Because teleportation is just is something that is there, that is normal. So when you're exploring the ninth world, I want to talk about a little bit more about, the variety of stuff that they really set up really interesting. They have some interesting locations like the Steadfast, which is kind of like a collection of small kingdoms that each one's kind of got its own society. And they give you details on each one, but they're so vastly different that you could pick an area that fits the theme you're going for, whether it's floating, crystal sky fields or some undead place. It reminded me of kind of like Ravnica, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you familiar with Ravnica, Alex? I know you've been playing some Magic the Gathering.
I mean, like, so, I know what it is.
Yeah, so in Ravnica, the whole entire plane of existence is just a bunch of different city locations. Yep. And then each one is run by different cultures, and, whether it's the Golgari, which are basically the living garbage disposals, right?
Yeah.
And so the ninth world kind of reminds me of that.
The entire spherical planet is just one massive city, like Coruscant in Star Wars.
Yep.
Just fantasy. Techno fantasy.
So...
and I just want to point out, because it's important to me and it's something that, like, I know I do it. I won as a dungeon master. So I want to point it out to other dungeon masters. So Pangaea is huge, right? It's all of the continents put together. There is only 10% of Pangaea that has been discovered. So if you're like me, and a lot of times you're like, damn, I really like this setting, but I want to make my own cities with their own intricacies and my own kings and my own, democracies and my own... just pick another part of Pangaea.
Yep.
And that's not counting the multiverse, different dimensions, different planets, or, shoot, the frickin' ocean.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it's so open.
Getting some vibes of, yeah. What is it? I just watched it. The sequel, the Black Panther 2.
Yeah.
Very much like that, where when you can dive into the water and find, you know, complex tech in the water.
Yep.
You know, and people surviving, and there's just so much you can do. And I think that that's what makes Numenera specifically so vast and such a wonderful setting to visit.
Well, crap. I need to watch Blue Submarine number 6 now.
There are some interesting things that I really think that make settings like this better than fantasy. In fantasy, there's basically 3 types of travel. Maybe 4. You can fly. You can teleport, and you can walk. Now, you might be taking a wagon or a horse, but it's still walking, right?
Sail.
That limits the type that you of travel that you can embody in a world. So, for instance, you're not going to have teleporting at every village, right? You're not going to have – I mean, even in Forgotten Realms, the big teleportation is only in the major cities, right?
Yep.
So it's not as common. Here – every random look, you can have waypoints that just allow you to skim, or which is, if you don't know what skimming is, it's interdimensional portal area that's you travel a certain distance, but it takes you farther in the real world. So you're basically walking a mile, but you traverse 100 miles or whatever. That is not out of place for something like this.
That's the Nether in Minecraft.
That's what?
In Minecraft, you can go into the Nether, which is the underworld. Mm-hmm. And for every block you move 8 on the overworld.
Yep. Oh, yeah. So same thing. So.
Or the web boy in Warhammer 40K.
Yeah.
Ooh, did nice. You gentlemen ever watch Firefly?
Yes.
Okay. So in Firefly, there are these spaceships that go around that do, you know, interdimensional, like long distance and small, short, like you're talking about. There was an episode of Firefly where they had a spaceship and they were going to go through this thing to, you know, go a long distance. And what actually ended up happening is it was a trap. Like, it wasn't a real one. It was a bogey, and it just fucking got stuck in a net. And this was actually one of the worst. This was one of the worst episodes, because I think this is the one where Mal almost dies.
Yeah.
The main character almost dies. And my friend told me this was the season finale.
Oh,
my friend told me that this was the last episode of the series. And so Mal's like, it's one of the most memorable and dramatic moments, because you're like, oh, it's interdimensional. It's fast traveling. Yeah, it's totally fine. Everything's good. No, what? And someone fucked with it. So, of course, the first thing that I think of whenever you're like traveling a long distance, what if someone puts a bogey up and then they enter in, and then all of a sudden they're in a jail, or all of a sudden they're in a dungeon, all of a sudden they're in the underground?
That's awesome. I love that.
I think the reason why I'm thinking about this is because I just got trapped by a chest in Elden Ring and got translocated to a dungeon, and I have to crawl my way out of it now.
I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. If you steal from this dude, right, and if you come back there.
Well, you're stealing, so I don't.
He puts down a trap chest. You open it, and you get teleported to a place that's like 50 times higher than your current level. So you gotta literally like rat your way out, and people just come up and they'll kick you and you die.
Sounds like an awesome adventure idea.
Holy crap, the game is so fucking hard.
Yes, so, it is. So back to the exploring, because one thing I want to touch on in Numenera's unique setting is the different ways that you can travel.
Yep.
And because the details of the way they include ciphers working only once, you can give unique ways of traveling regularly and only let them work for a certain amount of time before the battery dies and they don't know how to recharge it. So it becomes a useless hunk of metal, for instance. So as a GM, I think this makes for wonderful opportunities to play with that. I mean, can you imagine in your second encounter of a new RPG jumping on some hover bikes and having a battle with some robotic birds or vultures or something that are alien creatures that are flying around, and then somebody's automatic cipher boat thing run out of juice mid-flight? You know,
the thing I think is so amazing about the one-time use items is that you can give your players a one-time use item that's super powerful, and you're not gonna break the game because oopsie daisy, it had one charge.
Yep.
That would be amazing. I would love to be able to do that. So like if you want to do like a Halloween episode, right? So you want to give them this spooky wooky thing that, you know, summons ghosts or something like that. It just works for this Halloween episode. And then canon, it just breaks.
Yep. Jack-o'-lantern.
I just thought like a quick fast travel where you pay out a seed that might be in some sort of containment unit. Like, okay, seed, take me to where I want to go. You break the tube open. It's like it grows into a giant Venus flytrap, swallows the entire party whole, and then suddenly another Venus flytrap at the location you want to be spits you all out, the person dies.
That is some Mario level shit right there. So, and that's kind of the point I wanted to get across with exploring Numenera, because of the reality bending nature of the technology that's existed, you can have a lot of fun with the more boring aspects of any RPG, which is typically the traveling.
Yep.
And I think because you can find random things such as anti-gravity machines or, you know, space shuttles or, you know, some other strange travel mechanism, whether it's skimming or rifts, right? Opening a rift that stays up for so long, but the characters don't know. What if it's like sliders where you find a device that randomly just lets you slide to some other location through a wormhole, and if you miss it, it stops functioning.
Yeah.
So if you don't take the slide while you're, if you're trying to get home, like that would be a good get home sort of quest where you guys get sucked up through a crazy doctor's experiment into this portal that drops you somewhere in Numenera where you're not normally from. Remember, Alex already mentioned Pangaea only has about 10% of it discovered, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you end up somewhere you don't know, your character's goals are probably to get home. And so they got to constantly, jump through these things and enter these strange, random, episodic kind of challenges. And that's not, I don't feel like that's something you could easily do in fantasy, right?
No.
Depends.
I mean, unless one of you guys is a crazy mage, I guess. But here's
the thing. The only way that you're going to get that kind of stuff to happen is if you run a high fantasy setting. And a lot of people, including my significant other, prefer and almost exclusively play in low fantasy settings. And low fantasy settings just means that there's low magic. Like there's not, magic's very, very rare and stuff like that. And so the only way, so you have to, it like pigeonhole, like it tunnels you into a specific way to play like Dungeons and Dragons or any other fantasy game. And this one doesn't. You can play low magic if you want to, but you can also play high magic and it encourages you to play high magic. So like if you like high magic fantasy games, you'll like this game a lot.
Absolutely. And I agree 100%. So is there anything else we want to touch on, whether the lore or the setting itself, before we get into an overview of how to run the Cypher system?
And there's more, and I assume it's focusing more on the DM side of things, correct?
Well, no, it does include details, but yeah, you're right. Probably mostly the GM side.
Yeah.
Then the next episode, we will talk about character creation, which will focus heavily on the players. Yeah. So, Alex, do you have anything?
Before we get into the crunch, I think that it would be very, if I just came up with this right now, so I'm just saying it right now. I think it would be really good if we all gave it a crunch level, if we gave every single system we play a crunch level, because for some people, the first question that they ask me is it crunchy? I'll tell people that I play other games and they're like, how crunchy? Like, it seems to be an obsession right now.
So we would have to set a ranking system then.
I would say keep it simple, do a scale of 1 to 5.
Yep.
That's
so
what I was saying.
You classify
so
as
a
1 and what would you rate as a 5? You need two outliners that drive both ends of that spectrum.
I would say a 5 would be something like Shadowrun or the Sakonami Island Tactical Simulator.
Okay.
Exactly.
Would you put Pathfinder 1 or 3.5 in there?
No, I put that more 3.5. I would probably put about like a 3, and say and 2E. I feel like I gravitate more towards a 4, but they're both crunchy different ways. So
yeah,
I am in the same boat as you. I would kind of say to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons is like a 4. Yeah. 3.5 would definitely be like a 3.5. Sorry. But it would be to me.
There,
it would
but
be. But it would be to me.
What's a 1 then?
A 1 is if you have a single die to roll.
Is there an RPG?
So, like, for example, Blades in the Dark.
Oh.
Blades in the Dark has a single die roll, so I would consider it low crunch.
Yeah. Okay.
I would say for the crunch for the Cypher system, I would put a 2, but with an asterisk next to it.
Okay, what's the asterisk?
You always are riding, like, the middle of, here's my opinion, but...
It's crunchy with a side of soggy.
Yep. Yep. The actual character sheet itself is actually fairly basic, and the information you have on there is simple. The problem, though, is you have a lot of choices to go through.
Yep.
That you can throw on there.
See, when
that's,
I think crunch...
That's the asterisk.
When I think crunch, I think number-focused.
That's fair.
I think 3-5 Pathfinder.
Yeah.
I am a statistical engineer, and that's just annoying math for me.
Yeah. But I also do like put in the sheer amount of content, okay. And there's part of it too. So,
do you have any thoughts, Brandon?
It's crunch-erific.
One would be Dread.
Yeah, Dread is pretty good. I can see that.
Yes,
all right,
so Dread would be a one.
A crunch of 5 is just more complicated in rolls and numbers and such. Well, 1 is very
like nothing.
Stupefied easy.
Yes.
This is a 2.
I would agree with a 2. Do we all agree? It's a 2?
Yes. Mechanically, yes.
Yep.
Yep. I think that would be our rating for Crunch. This is a rules light game, and I think it's done really well. It's got just enough to keep everyone interested. So, Alex's Bombastic Oddities is now live on Kickstarter with rebrand.ly/OBO Kickstarter. Would you like to do it and talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I created a book that has accessibility in mind. So if you have reading problems like I do, if you have visual impairments, if you have anything like that, it's going to be made with larger font for you. And it is a book, but more than that, it is a book that has a collection of the most useful things I have ever created as a game master in a system agnostic setting that are meant to inspire you and invoke your own creativity without stepping on the toes of your creativity, because your creativity and your world and your imagination is the most important part here. So if you want to expand your brain and expand your creativity and really flex those muscles, go ahead and check it out. Alex's Bombastic Oddities.
It's now live, so visit at rebrand.ly/ABO Kickstarter. Back it now. I promise you're going to want to. So next we want to talk about the how to run the Cypher system.
Yep.
Overall, it's got a pretty traditional feel of character creation with the character sheet and everything. But something that really sets it apart is descriptors, type, and focus. Since I didn't actually create a character, y'all might be able to touch on this a little better than me.
Well, basically, Ken, your character is actually a very narrow set of guidelines.
Very narrow.
You just go down the list. That's about it.
Okay, so what's a descriptor?
All right, let me pull up my character sheet.
5.
So essentially, it says, I am blank, who blank about blank. And what happens is I am Alex, who is a, and then I use speaker, and speaker is your class, and then who has a foci, and your foci is your subclass, essentially.
Yep. And in my case, my character Mordecai is a mystical adept who commands mental powers.
And yes. So, to me, this is fantastic because this tells everyone in one sentence exactly
and
what your character is about. Not just their combat capability, but their skill set.
And everything I just said, as you said, had skills and stats attached to it.
Yep. So,
I just had to pick three things, arrange my numbers, that pick my talents, that was it.
I mean, it really was pretty quick.
And yep. I think it's very important to note that while the foci and the descriptor and all of those have very narrow meanings for what they are, they do have instructions of how to create your own.
Yes.
So if you don't like any of the foci and you want to make your own foci, at least in the SRD, there were instructions to create your own foci with your game master.
Yep.
Leaning on that a little bit, you start with the descriptor, which is basically a description of the character's personality, background, and abilities, and all that jazz.
Yes. I believe you start with type, actually, and then go from there.
Anyway, this isn't the full character build episode, so we don't gotta get into super details. The type, which determines your core abilities and skills, and then, of course, the, is it Is it foci or foci? Because she's got me questioning my life choices.
I said foci.
Foci? That's what I thought it was.
I have never heard someone say foci in my life. I have only heard foci.
I've never heard foci, ever.
So I thought it was Fochi.
Fochi.
I said, don't matter.
It doesn't really. I was just curious. And she's saying, I was like, have I been saying it wrong all these years? All right. So that's kind of the core of that. One of the things that I want to talk about as far as the way the game runs is from the GM perspective. As a GM, I don't have to roll any dice.
None.
And I love it. I found it so much less stressful to just choose a target number and let them go to town. Yep. That to me is huge. I think that takes away, GMs have a lot to do. Yep. In most games. So having one less thing to do, even if it's roll dice, which I understand as players, I love rolling dice.
Yeah.
But I hate it as a GM. Because first of all, people are always wondering if you're changing them, no matter even if you say you do or don't, right?
Yeah.
But secondly, that's just one more thing that I got to constantly keep track of instead of just saying the number, then putting all the weight on the players. It's like I'm handing off part of my responsibilities. And as a lazy person, that is perfect.
Yep.
Same. What do you guys think? Too. And gals.
it's okay.
I definitely think it sped things up a little bit.
Speeds things up. Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Definitely speeds it up.
Personally, as a person who almost exclusively game masters, I would be very interested in running this, not just because it is extremely in depth and the lore is so beautiful, but also it's like 0.5 of a game.
Yeah.
For me. Like, normally, whenever I'm playing Dungeons & Dragons, I have so much, like, initiative entries, I have so much to do before the game.
Yep.
This, it feels almost like this could be completely improv'd or, like, 15 minutes of prep.
Crap, proposed,
you
right.
Don't, because all of the monsters are just die. Like, that's it. Or no, all of the monsters have our hit points, and then they can do a certain amount of damage.
Mm-hmm.
For if it's a light weapon, a medium weapon, or a large weapon, or whatever it is, a heavy weapon. And so I would love to have this as a side. This would be, this would be perfect for that side game that you have with your college buddies that you've known for like 8 years, and you all have big boy jobs now, and you don't know when you can see each other. But when you do, you spend like 8 hours playing. You could play this. You could easily DM this game for 8 hours and not get a headache.
All right,
that's what jobs. I see this for.
Alicia got us some clarification on the plural of focus.
They're both right.
Yes. According to online dictionaries, American pronunciation is foci, whereas British is foci.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
I can't believe I got that right.
Technically, we both
did. We all did. So we can all celebrate our genius.
I didn't get it right. I thought it was Fochi. I'm just dumb.
So So that was one of my big things about the GMing. Yep. It's easy. You just talk. That's...
Yep.
There's no numbers for you to deal with as far as dice rolls, which is great. That means no rolling hit points for monsters, no rolling attacks, no rolling damage, none of that, which springs into the next detail.
Yeah. The only die, for the most part, that players have to worry about is a d20.
Yep.
That's it. Now, use it for most of everything. Now, that said, you do use a d100 for some charts here and there, such as if you're in the cipher, or a d6 for recovery, but otherwise... Just a d20, that's it.
So I mentioned the target number. So there's actually two systems with the roll targets. So you have the target number, which is what the character has to beat, but you also have a difficulty number. So the GM sets the difficulty number. Let's say a difficulty number goes from 1 to 10.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the target number is 3 times that number.
So it's 3, well, actually 0 to 30.
Yes. So that's a pretty big range. But
you can't roll above a 20.
Well, you can't roll above a 20. But there are things that can help you. And I know, Brandon, you talked about how you like this aspect in it. You want to touch on that a little bit?
Yes. Okay. So as a warrior, I was able to put a certain number of points into a pool that goes into might, speed, and intellect. Well, I had jack and intellect because I was fucking dumb. But I had plenty in speed, and most of it was in might. Now, if I want to try and... jump over a gap.
Let's all laugh at him really quick because he was might stacked and still got choked like a bitch.
eat shit. So let's say I'm going to jump over a guy that's 10 feet wide. How? What kind of a difficulty would that be for you?
I would say a 10 foot high, I would easily put that at about a 4 or 5. We'll say 5.
5. So the
DC most people
would be,
can't do that, right? So it would be a 15 target number.
The DC would be 15. I'd have to roll a d20 and hit 15 or higher to get it. That's just the roll. There's no modifiers like you find in D&D.
No.
But instead, I can bring it down. I have something called edge in might. That all that's saying is I have an edge in this because I am
really good at it.
I'm really good at it. I'm a warrior. I have a lot of might. That's already going to bring the difficulty down by 1 point, making it a 4 instead of a 5, changing it from a 15 to a, 12?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And if you have a skill.
And if you have a skill that does it too, that can also bring that difficulty down.
And
if you use effort, you can take away points from your pool to bring it down by one more level again, making it easier and easier and easier.
And and if another player assists you,
goes down again.
I didn't know that one.
Assuming they have skills
relevant. You have to have the skill that's relevant, but yeah.
Or justify it in a way that's relevant.
Right.
But
so
yeah, if you can get it down.
He basically just took that target from 15 down to what?
0.
When he only did 4, right? That'd bring it down to 1.
But if another player assisted.
That would include the 4, right?
Let's see. I did effort.
Effort.
I got a skill that brings it down.
You have an edge.
I have edge. That's 3. A player helped me.
That's 4.
That's
brings
4.
It to 1.
Good point. And depending on how advanced your skill is too, though, they can bring down one.
That
more.
Also brings it down more. But you can also include one last one that he missed, which is an asset. So maybe asset. He has a pogo stick too. So now he doesn't have to roll at all. He just succeeds.
Or a rope.
It's because the difficulty went from a 5 to a 0. And 0
which
times
0
3,
times
is,
3
0, so.
Is what?
0.
What is everyone's thoughts on that kind of mechanic? Obviously, I know he likes it because we talked about
it. It's very unique. And
yeah.
That's what I like about it.
And
the part I like about it is it puts some tasks out of the realm of possibility for some characters.
Yep.
But if some character is built for that situation or has skills that apply to it, that could bring that.
Let them shine.
Yeah, like bring that impossible situation to the realm of possibility to even something they can do no problem.
Yep. What were you going to say, Alex?
Not only do I think that this is very, like, unique, it's also extremely intuitive.
Yeah.
Whenever I listen to the words that are being used, like edge, I mean, we literally say in English, we have an edge up on things.
Yep.
Like, they used intuitive thinking and intuitive, like,
words.
Like connections in the brain to all that already exist. They created on top of those pathways. And I think that that's really, really fascinating. But also for me, from an accessibility standpoint, that makes my life a lot easier. Because memorizing words and making them have new definitions is incredibly difficult for me. So if I can just look at edge and say, oh, I have an edge up on this.
Yep.
Or if I look at the pool and say, oh, I have a big pool, a bucket, a pool of things that I can – jelly beans that I can give out, it creates a lot more
you toss
ease
a lot of jelly beans in
for
your pools?
Me to be able to learn it. Yes.
I'm going to go swimming in a jelly bean pool.
What happens when you give away all of your jelly beans?
You're screwed. You're all out.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's kind of, we kind of glossed over a little bit, but that pool runs out and
you
basically
die.
Start to get worn out, debilitated, and there's detriments that come with that. So
but,
you have to choose and when it's worth the risk to do those things.
Like my pools, for example, is I had a might score of 8, a speed of 10, and an intellect of 16. And my pool, because my stat is 16 intellect, I have a pool of 16 points of intellect I can spend.
Right.
And once that pool's empty, I can't get the boost I get before. And it's worth noting, these three pools combined also doubles your health.
Oh, yeah.
This is also how you die, because your pool is your health.
And you have 4 lives? 4 lives?
Something
well,
like.
Pools, kind of. You got 4
you
debilitating
have
levels, tiers.
Ah.
Very much like wounds.
Half impaired, debilitated, dead.
Yeah.
Yep. You don't want to be the last one.
No.
No.
Dead is bad. But the rest you can kind of limp on with, and you, as you recover and stuff, or rest and stuff, you recover that a little bit.
And
there's
also
another game that uses that mechanic.
Huh?
When your ability scores go down, when your pools go down to 0 or whatever, and you start dying, there's another game that does that.
Yeah.
It's a House on Haunted Hill.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, if you lose all of your points and your physical strength, then your character's
pretty
done.
Much any game that has hit points, if you lose all your points, you're dead.
Yeah, but these are physical attributes, they're not hit points.
Oh, okay.
That's just where points. It came from.
Pulls.
Fuck you.
All right, so there's another thing. We already talked enough about Cypher, so I don't think we have to go much into that.
Yeah.
But something that I think is fantastic is the way combat is held. Remember I told you no dice rolling on my end?
Yep.
Basically, all dice rolls for attacks from enemies are based on their stat block. They're static, and the players make defensive rolls against the speed, might, or intellect.
Yeah. Now, some creatures might have some modifications, but let's say you have like a... Yep. Basically, a difficulty rating 3 creature. Okay, I now know every single stat I need to know about that creature.
Yep, pretty much. But you don't have to reveal that to the players.
No. Which basically means in order to hit it, I need to roll 9 or better with whatever attack I'm doing. When it attacks me, I need to roll 9 or better in my defenses.
Yep, and it's pretty straightforward. Once again, it speeds up the game significantly.
Yep. And of course, there's armor, which basically acts as a damage reducer.
Not an increased armor class like in some other games.
Yes.
So, I thought that was really cool. I know that you mentioned earlier, Alex, that you had some points you want to talk on equipment. I think this would be a good time to toss that in there.
Yeah. So, just again, I have a lot of difficulty reading, trying to discern equipment was incredibly difficult. And it's really the only negative point that I have. Now, it was Numenera equipment, not Cypher system equipment. I want to be clear.
Yeah.
In the actual Numenera book, if you go into where the equipment is, they don't, or no, in the Cypher system book, whenever you look at the equipment section, they don't actually have just a universal equipment, because they do equipment by inexpensive, normal, expensive, and then something else. They have an expensive cost, so it's all simplified. So essentially what happens is whenever you get a set of items that you're allowed to purchase, a single purchase in each one of the different sections. There's not really a universal list. In order to find a list, you actually have to go into the individual settings, so like fantasy, sci-fi, modern, and look at the list there, but they don't like say that anywhere.
It's not spelled out.
So it becomes incredibly confusing. The way that I got around this, if you just want a universal list, is actually the SRD has a universal list. So I don't, but yeah, that was kind of the thing that was really frustrating for me. And I actually ended up having to like give up and ask people for help with my equipment because I was so confused.
But once I knew it was organized, I said, oh, okay. But
it's not intuitive.
No.
At all.
Yes.
But not every book is,
the rest of the game
right?
is so intuitive.
Yeah, right.
Now I can understand the logic of dividing each equipment type by setting, especially once you know about it. It would have been nice, as Elsa was saying, when you like read the actual section, all 4 pages of it, when they, like, let's say expensive and expensive and so on and so forth, they give you examples that are so vague, it's like, that doesn't really help me. Wow. The only solid point you're really given is what type of level of armor or weapons were what expense, and that was about it.
Yeah, that's not super intuitive, so. I think Brandon had an issue with the armor at one point, too. He couldn't figure out what it did, right?
Like Alex, for example, I recall you could not figure out how, like, what's my stun stick do exactly? And we ended up finding in the sci-fi setting chapter.
Well, yeah. And that's the other thing that's worth pointing out, too, that some of the things are very vague.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't talk too much about when you're rolling your 20, your D20, you get triggers on 18, 19, and 20, I think.
Yes.
Minor effects and major effects, which are really open to agreement between the player and the GM at that point.
And more damage if you're attacking.
Yeah. So, you had a point about the armor. I was laughing at it from my screen because I found it really quickly, but I know he struggled, which means it's not intuitive enough if somebody's struggling to find it.
Pretty much the same issue Alex had was any equipment you find armor, and they say it's the same concept of light, medium, and heavy armor.
And that's all really spelled out.
And it tells you the speed debuffs that you get, depending on which one you get, but it doesn't say how armor works. And it should speculate that section how armor works.
Well, it does speculate. Isn't that the problem? It's supposed to be specific?
Okay. What did I say?
Speculate.
Maybe I don't know what speculate means. Supposed to be specific, goddammit.
Yes. So,
and one thing we haven't really touched on, which I think we could use more which I honestly kind of wish came up more often in our game.
Yeah, I failed. I'm a terrible GM. I'm sorry. I know where you're going with this because I knew it the whole time we played.
No, I mean, it was all of our first time playing, so I'm not going to expect us to get it perfect the first time.
I did.
Means. Okay.
I expected to be perfect. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, GM intrusions, right?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, so, yeah. In lieu of controlling, rolling a bunch of dice and other things like that, the game introduces GM intrusions, which are basically challenger twists that the GM can introduce based on roles that earn a reward called experience. Now, not in the typical sense of what experience is, but basically...
It's more of a character currency.
Yeah, basically, instead of waiting for a natural one or a natural trip for some event to occur, you can actually choose when an event occurs based on the actions the players take. So let's say, for instance, and I'm just going to make up a scenario, that the players decide they want to go left at a fork instead of right, but they decide they're going to eeny, meeny, miny, mo this shit, and so they decide to go left. I kind of have a plan of what's going to go on, but they're looking for a staff of destruction, right? So they go down there, and I ask them to give me like a perception check or something to investigate, right? Maybe I decide, okay, they did really, really, really well. So not only am I going to tell them that the staff of destruction is in the other direction, but I want to do it in an interesting way. So I'm going to make that scenario, instead of just telling them, I'm going to have them run into a robotic security guard that might have the information, but now it's going to beat their faces in since they're intruders before that happens. So I've used their dice roll to add a complication to the scenario to still drive the results of their success. They figured it out. They succeeded. Instead of just saying, oh, it's not here, it's the other way, we've now added, I think it's akin to story branching, which anybody that listens to Critic Academy knows I love. And so for me, that's a really powerful tool that also yields a reward to the players in the form of an XP token, either one for everyone or two for one player who can then give it out to one other player, I think.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a really great tool because it basically in the rules is saying you guys should be ready for me to throw a curveball at any point, basically.
Right. And what you can use these XP is for a couple things. One, you can spend one at any point, really, to a couple things. You can either, one, reroll a die roll, which I actually did twice in our game, or you can do a player intrusion to modify the scene in some way, and some of the character types give you some options.
Plot points!
Right.
I love it.
Like, the adept I have one is like, as we mentioned, that once you use a cipher, for the most part, you expend them.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was I can recharge a cipher.
That's awesome.
Use it again.
So,
but, and the other thing you use XP for is to advance your character in some way, shape, or form. And I believe it costs, what, 4 XP to do it?
So you have to save them up.
Right. So you have to choose which way you're going to boost your character in that regard.
Right.
Not only mention that because we only got 3 XP the entire session, but...
Yeah. Well, once again, we only played one game, so...
Yeah.
Brandon or Alex, do you guys have anything to add to that?
I think that this XP system is one of my favorite XP systems I've ever come across.
Yep.
Because XP now becomes a commodity.
Yeah.
So it's like, ooh, do I want to level up or do I want to stop this troll from just barging in?
Yep. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody's like caught in jail and they're like, oh, it looks like somebody have already been digging for 3 years with a spoon. There's a secret tunnel here. Sorry, here's my XP point.
Yep.
There's a tunnel. Oh, that's great, but it might collapse. Oh, look, it collapsed on you. Sorry. Because I'm not a Wishmaster type DM at all.
And the last thing I want to mention, too, is there are tiers that your characters play at.
Yeah, I think there's 4, right?
Six.
Well, see, I don't know.
And each tier, of course, affects which abilities you can acquire.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the whole character branching comes into play.
Right, and as does your character type, your foci, and so on and so forth.
Right. Now here is our Unearthed Tips and Tricks system agnostic content for your tabletop RPG game. Our player tip of the podcast today is the power of active listening. Somebody else is going to have to talk on this because my brain disappears in another thought when I'm supposed to be listening.
What?
Like that.
Essentially what the power of active listening means is that whether you are acting like the one doing the role playing at the time or if you're just, you know, in the background at the moment, whether it's somebody else's time to shine or whether it's, you know, your time to shine, you should be paying attention to what's going on at the table. You shouldn't be on your phone. You shouldn't be reading manga. You shouldn't be doing other things.
Whoa, hang on. Not reading what? Manga? You're gonna have to scratch that off. We're gonna have to do a second take. Because what else am I gonna do on other people's turn if I can't read manga?
Pay attention.
No.
Oh, damn it.
Pay attention.
I'd also would say to a degree, depends on what they're doing on their phone. But anyway.
Essentially what active listening means is that even though you are not the one that is currently speaking, you are still participating in a way by understanding the knowledge and understanding the information that is being placed in front of you by these people. For example, if it's not your turn, I understand if you want to scroll on Instagram, but if I come to your turn while you've been scrolling on Instagram and say, hey, what you want to do? And you say, oh, I don't know.
I guess fireball.
Kind of a dick move.
Yep.
So the best way to avoid pissing off your DM and accidentally having your character die is to actually pay attention to the game that you're playing, because this is a cooperative game. This is a group game. We're all just doing this for fun, guys.
And to kind of springboard off of that, I think that part of what makes active listening so important is players, when they're playing, are telling you what's important to them.
Right.
So by listening, you're showing respect for their time and what they love about the game. And when you don't do that, you're almost giving a signal of the game. This is all about me. I only care about myself. And storytelling in a role-playing game is all about everybody's love for the game and sharing that experience together. So when you're clueless and it's your turn for a long, there was a while there where I skipped you. I had a timer. Were you here when I did the timer?
Yeah.
I had one of the little Pictionary timers. I had cared. No, I flipped it. You were done. Now, anybody that noticed that if you are actively actually ready and it just took you a long time to make sure you moved your minis or did anything, I never let it lapse. But there's sometimes where I'd have to cut people off because there's five players. You've had 15 minutes to think about what the hell you're going to do. At the very least, your default action is going to be dodge. And that's it. Shoot. Pay attention.
Clash of Classes, we had a timer. Now, granted, mostly as a threat because we never actually implemented it, but hey.
Yeah. And so basically, the power of active listening is a tool to engage you in what interests the other players and to show that you care about the time that they're spending, not just your own time.
Yep.
All righty. That'll do it for our player tip of the podcast, the power of active listening. All right. I think that'll do it for this episode of Dice and Dialogue Cypher System Part 1. Join us in 2 weeks when we discuss the character creation process for Numenera. If you enjoy the show and you want to support us, visit us at CritAcademy.com. Follow us on social media. Please leave us a review on your favorite podcast catcher.
And on YouTube, be sure to click like and subscribe and click the bell.
I am your host, Justin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your co-host, Alex.
I'm your co-host, Brandon. Thanks for listening.
Have fun on your adventures, and don't be a dick!
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.